Okay. Start with the beginning of the Sedra. I'm going to cover a few different ideas. Torah starts v'yikhu li truma. Now, probably it should have said v'yitnu li truma. Give me a donation. Why does it say take for me a donation? The simple answer probably is it's talking to the gaboyim. We're going around collecting the donations, so take from the Jewish people their donations. But the Sfarim say a different idea completely. And that is the following. Turnus Rufus HaRosha once asked Rabbi Akiva the following question. If God loves poor people so much, why doesn't he support them? Why does he give it over to rich people to support the poor people? Cut out the middleman. So Rabbi Akiva said, it is ridiculous to assume that God can't give the money directly to the poor person. If we believe that God gives extra money to the rich one and instructs him to give it to the poor person, then God could give it directly to the poor person. So it's not for the sake of the poor person. The purpose of tzedakah is for the sake of the rich people, that they should have a merit in giving tzedakah. God wants to merit the rich people to have that merit instead of him doing it himself. And that idea is echoed in the following. When Rus came home after a day of collecting all of the grain that the Torah gives to the poor, peah, the corner of the field, and the things that are forgotten, and all different kinds of things that the Torah gives to the poor. So Naomi asked her, where were you today? She said, the man I did for today was Boaz. The obvious question, what did she do for Boaz? Took his money? And Boaz did for her? She didn't do anything for him. The Gemara says from there, Yoser mimashe ha'osher osim ha'ami, ha'ami osim ha'osher. More than the rich person does for the poor person does for the rich person. Because the rich person only gives the poor person money, which God could have given them. But the poor person gives the rich person a merit, a mitzvah, that even God can't give, because mitzvahs you have to do on your own. So the poor person really is benefiting the rich person. That's why it says v'yikhu li truma. You're really taking, and when you give, you're getting the merit. You're giving somebody else, but basically the main reason that you're giving is that you should be able to have that merit. That's why God wanted to give you the right and the opportunity to give. I think that explains something about Purim. Okay, on Purim, there is a mitzvah of matanos levyonim, to give tzedakah to one present to two different anim. Okay. On the other hand, when you give the presents to your friend, to the rich people, you give two presents. Mishloach manos, and you give it to one person. Give one person two presents, and when it comes to the ani, you give two people, but one thing each, not two. It would seem just the opposite. When it comes to the tzedakah, you should give two. When it comes to the present for your rich friend, give him one. Why did the Rabbanu Shlom say, give two aniyim, one thing, and when it comes to the rich person, give one person two things? The Rambam says that if you have a choice to give, let's say you have $100 to give to tzedakah, you can give four aniyim, $25 each, which will be a nice amount for each one, or you can give one person $100. Without certain exceptions, the Rambam says it's better to give four people $25 than to give one $100. Why? Because a person is judged according to how many acts of kindness he does. And the more you do, the more it ingrains in you that conduct. And therefore, it's better to do four times tzedakah than one time bigger tzedakah. Now, even though the poor person gains more, but like we said, the main idea here is not to benefit the poor person. God can take care of poor people. The Rabban Shem wants you to have the merit. And there's more merit in doing something more times than doing it once in a bigger way. Quantity is better than quality, because quantity creates a plan of action. It creates you get into the habit of doing something, and the main thing is for your merit that you should get into the habit of wanting to give to other people. That's why the word vinosnu, in a different pesedra, vinosnu ish kofer nafsho, the word vinosnu can be read both ways. Vinosnu, if you read it backwards, also vinosnu. There's a word for that, I don't remember what it is. That's it. Thank you. Right, a word that can be read with another language, but it works in Hebrew too. Right, vinosnu, if you spell it backwards, it's still vinosnu. Palindrome, yeah?
Palindromic.
So the reason is because when you give, you get back. You give, but you get the merit for giving. So the giving goes both ways, a two-way street. In any case, that's why you give what's it called, two different aniyim and only one thing. Masha'en kain, for the rich person, you give two things, because who said you'll be rich tomorrow? You might as well have something, you know, for security, because nobody guarantees the person can remain rich either. The the same thing applies to supporting Torah. Person should feel that if he supports Torah institutions, that he's basically benefiting. Even though he's supporting the Torah, but the support Torah is really supporting him. The Aron. Okay, it says that even though the people who carried the Aron seemingly were carrying it, but there was a miracle that the Aron carried the people who were carrying it, and their feet were above the ground, and it floated them across. The symbolism being, people think they're supporting the Torah, but in fact the Torah is supporting them. In fact, the Chafetz Chaim says that that's the meaning of the following pasuk that we say every time we put back the Torah. Eitz Chaim hi l'machazikim ba, v'tomcheha me'ushar. The Torah is a tree of life to the people who hold on to it, who support it, and who support it, and it's a and the people who support it are fortunate. So he says there's two ways of supporting Torah. One is called tamicha. Tamicha means to support something. People who think that they're supporting Torah institutions, they're doing the Torah institution a favor by donating to the Torah institution, they definitely will be fortunate, they'll get rewarded, but that's not the highest level. You know what the highest level is? Eitz Chaim hi, where it's a tree of life, l'machazikim bo. The word l'achazik literally means to hold on for dear life. If you're drowning and a log passes by and you grab onto the log to hold on to it so you don't drown, that's called l'achazik bo, to hold on to it for dear life. People who understand that by supporting Torah institutions, they're the ones who are benefiting, they're holding on to for dear life, then for them it's a tree of life. For the people who think that they're supporting the Torah institution, they're doing the Torah institution a favor, so for them they're fortunate, but it's not a tree of life. The Chafetz Chaim, true to his word, did the following. Okay, he didn't only say nice things, he lived according to them. Somebody once came to the Chafetz Chaim and offered him to underwrite the entire budget of Rabban Yeshiva. Whatever he couldn't raise, he would provide the deficit. So Chafetz Chaim said, I appreciate your offer, I can't accept it. So he says, there's something wrong with my money, why can't you accept that I'm willing to underwrite the budget of your yeshiva? He said, because God could underwrite the budget of my yeshiva, so why doesn't he? Because he wants to give the merit to the Jewish people to support my yeshiva. I can't let you take it all for yourself. You have to share it with others. Now, if somebody would offer me that, I would take it. Telling you right now, I would fail the test. No problem. I'm sure if somebody offered that to the Panevish Rav Zatzal, he would have taken it and opened another yeshiva. But that was the Chofetz Chaim. So I can't let you take that entire merit. It has to be shared by other people. There's a story that they tell in Tells It's not necessarily representative of every situation, but it's an interesting story. It's a true story. The Telza Rosh Yeshiva, the one who founded Telza Yeshiva at the end of the 1800s, his name was Reb Lazer Gordon. Lazer Gordon, when he got married, he wasn't yet Reb Lazer Gordon, he was a 18, 19-year-old Avreich, but he showed that he had, what's it called, promise of being somebody special. His father-in-law was the Rav of Asheshuk, a rabbi, not a rich man, and he, his name was Rav Avram Yitzchok Nevi'ezer. And in those days, the way they supported the young couple, especially those that showed promise to develop into great Torah sages, they didn't give them money. They lived with the in-laws. So they moved in with the father-in-law and mother-in-law, and they ate at their table, and they didn't obviously have any rent to pay. And they lived like that for 5 years. He accepted 5 years to support them at his table. At the end of the 5 years, Reb Lazer Gordon told his wife that we've been here 5 years. We already have a few little children. And it's difficult for your parents now to support us. The deal was 5 years, and I've had an offer for a rabbinate in a certain city, and I want permission from your father to leave. So the wife went to her father, and she told him what her husband said, and she said, we want your bracha to leave. The father turned white, and he said, no, 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 you can't leave. You've got to stay another 5 years. So the wife went back to her husband and told her what the father said. He said, look, I feel uncomfortable, but if it means so much to your father that we stay here another 5 years, then we'll stay here another, I'll forego the position, and we'll stay here another 5 years. 5 years went by, now they have already few children, older children, it's becoming hard to support them, to feed them even. And he had now a very prestigious rabbanus offered to him. So he sent his wife in again. This time the mother-in-law was there too. So she says, you know, we already have a sizable family. We know it's difficult for you. My husband has a very prestigious offer of a rabbanus. We want your permission to leave. So the mother-in-law said, you know, that she's right. How long can we support them? And the father-in-law said, I don't know who's supporting who. But I don't want to stand in the way of my son-in-law's career. If he has this prestigious position, I give him my bracha, go gesundheit. The day they left, the father-in-law died. And then the mother-in-law understood what he meant, I don't know who's supporting who. Sometimes a person thinks he's supporting Torah when really the Torah is supporting him. You don't know. You don't know. So therefore, the Torah says, v'yikhu li truma, take. Because ultimately you are the beneficiary if you give tzedakah, if you support Torah institutions. The merit is the ikr that the Rabban Shem wants the wealthy person to merit, not so much that the poor person should get, because the poor person got his other ways of supporting the poor people if he wanted to. Okay, just as an aside, one of the zechuyos that this country has is in the fact that for years they supported Torah institutions, right, in a very, very fine way. And it gave the Medina a merit. Now that they cut off a good portion of that funding, it's the Torah institutions will survive. There's always ways that God will provide for them. But it's a shame that the Medina is losing that schus. They don't have that schus to the same degree that they used to have before. Hopefully, they'll come to the senses and realize that part of what Klal Yisrael is not just an army and not just a politics, but there's also a spiritual side. You know, when I was in America, when I was of draft age, was the Vietnam War. And there was a draft. But I was exempt from the draft because I was 4D. 4D means a divinity student. It applied not only to people learning in yeshivas, it applied to ministers and priests, anybody learning in a seminary, because the American government understood that aside from the physical protection of the country, you need spiritual protection also. Right? The American government understood that. and they therefore exempted clergymen, people learning for the clergy in seminaries and in Protestant institutions and in Jewish institutions, to continue to create a spiritual spirit for the country. And hopefully a good portion of the people in the country and a good portion of people in the government understand that. There happens to be people in the government now that are very vocal, that don't understand it. It's Hashem, the Rebbe Hashem, should either give them the chokhmah to yes, understand it, or to see to it that they're not so vocal. Okay, one way or the other. Okay. Adkan for politics. Next. The and it could be for that reason, however, the people who support Torah have a tremendous, tremendous merit. And that's why it says that the Badin, which you carry the Aron with, you couldn't separate them from the Aron. They always had to be in the Aron. The Badin represented the people who support the Torah. The Aron and the Luchos represented the people who learn Torah. You can't separate them. They won't be separated in this world, because the supporters support the Torah, and they won't be separated in the next world, because the same reward that goes to the people learning the Torah will go for the people who are supporting the people learning the Torah. That's why Yisachar and Zvulun, right? Yisachar got the same reward that Zvulun got, for learning, because they provided them with the means to be able to learn. And they shared the reward in this world and in the next world. And not only that, but Zvulun is always mentioned before Yisachar, because he made it possible for Yisachar to sit and learn Torah. So he comes first. Okay, another thing. It says, we're talking about the Aron carrying itself and carrying the people who carry it. However, that was a miracle. The Aron was gold on the inside and gold on the outside. Okay, and it was wood in the middle. Okay, so the Aron was made, it was a wooden box, the Aron, but you covered it with gold on the outside and gold on the inside. How did they do it, Rashi said? They made three boxes. A larger gold box, a medium-sized wooden box, and a smaller gold box. So the Aron was the middle one, was the wood. Inside the middle, they would put a little gold box, which covered the inside walls of the wood with gold. And they take the wooden box and put it in a bigger gold box, so now the outside walls of the wood were covered with gold. So the Aron was covered with gold inside and out. Why? It's a symbol. The Aron and the Luchos represent the person learning Torah. Person who learns Torah should be gold on the inside and gold on the outside. Or as Chazal say, Tocho Kibaro. His inside should be like his outside. He should be as good on the outside as he's on the good side, and vice versa. He shouldn't only look good, he should really on the inside be good. And he shouldn't just be on the inside good, people should recognize that he's a good person. So he should be gold on the inside, gold on the outside. So the Daz Sekeinu Mibalei HaTosfos asked the following question. Wouldn't it have been more symbolic if the Aron was solid gold? Forget about wood with gold on the inside, gold on the outside. Why didn't they make the Aron, why didn't God tell them to make the Aron solid gold? And a Talmid Chacham should be solid gold. So some answer that question in a very, a deep way. Some say that the Aron, the person who learns Torah, is a living being. So it had to be represented, the Aron had to be something alive, like a tree, vegetation, not metal. Metal's dead. It had to be covered with metal. But the Aron itself had to be Eitz Chayim, it's a tree of life. It had to be something that had life. So it had to be wood. That's one idea. Rav Shamshon Feld Hirsch, maybe Rabbi Breuer, one of the two, says a very deep idea. He says a Talmid Chacham, on the one hand, his core ideals can't be malleable. They can't be something, they have to be rigid. His core ideals have to be rigid, like wood. Wood you can't bend out of shape. You can cut it up, but it stays the same shape. Metal is malleable, you can change the shape. A Talmid Chacham, his core ideals are rigid. But on the inside and outside, he can be flexible. That's where he could be flexible. There's a place to be flexible, but there's a place to be rigid too. The core ideals have to be rigid. Otherwise, a Talmud Chacham has to know how to be flexible and adapt to situations inside and outside. Okay. The Das HaKeinim says a very simple answer. Not a deep answer, a simple answer. He says, it's true. It would be much more symbolic if the Aram was solid gold. However, if it was solid gold, a box with that dimensions would have been too heavy to carry. It would have weighed a tremendous amount. So therefore, it had to be basically wood with a little gold on the inside and a little gold on the outside, a thin layer of gold, in order that it was carryable. Now, I told you that the Aron carried the people who carried it. That's a miracle. And ain't some chamalanes, you don't rely on miracles. It had to be carryable naturally too. That's what he said. Had to be carryable naturally. Sounds like a very simple, practical answer. But let me tell you how I used this answer once, and I think it teaches us a tremendous lesson. I had a girl in my kehila in Miami about 40 years ago, and she was about 16 years old. She had a mother. Her father was not in the picture at all. I don't know why. Either he had died or they were divorced. I never found out what happened to the father. Just her and a mother. One daughter and a mother. The mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. She was not religious. She knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. She grew up totally assimilated, knew nothing. Mom is nothing. And the daughter started going to NCSY, to what's it called, a youth group in America. And she got turned on to Yiddishkeit, and she became frum. And as usual, many people who become frum, Bali Tshuva, go to the extremes, especially in the beginning. They don't know. And this poor mother knew nothing. The girl would come home every day with some new thing, right? One day she came home and she said, I can't have any of the clothes I have, I can't wear anymore. They're not modest. I have to go get a completely new wardrobe. The mother was a tzaddikus. She wasn't religious, but she was a tzaddikus. Anything her daughter wanted, she gave her. Right? Many times parents will do anything for their children except that they want to be religious. You want to be a drug addict, I'll support your addict. You want to be frum, forget it. You want to kosher me, forget it. This mother would do anything for this daughter. But she didn't know if the daughter really, you know, knew what she was doing. Every time she came up with some other thing that the mother thought was crazy because she never heard of these things. So the mother knew that the girl came to my shul and that she asked me questions. So the mother would call me and say, is this really necessary? Is this necessary? Can you explain this to me? My daughter came home and told me this fantastic thing, right? And the mother would be in touch with me constantly, right, to find out if, you know, if her daughter is, if this is really on the up and up, you know, her daughter just wants a new wardrobe of clothing or whatever. It really is necessary or whatever. One day the mother calls me. And she says, Rabbi, I thought you were an Orthodox rabbi. I said, I am. She said, then how come you don't eat kosher? I said, okay, let me hear what this one is. Tell you the background. In Miami at the time, there was one glatt kosher butcher shop. We brought the meat in. There was no local shechita in Florida because there wasn't enough grazing land in Florida. So the meat had to be brought from the Midwest. I think from Denver. They shipped it in from Denver. And it was for the whole community. There was only one glatt kosher butcher shop in the whole community. And everybody, Miami Beach, North Miami Beach, bought from that one butcher shop. The butcher shop was OU, glatt kosher. All the Rabbonim had a group called the Orthodox Rabbinical Council. And the Orthodox Rabbinical Council was made up of all many different Rabbonim. And they all gave their stamp of approval to this butcher shop. And that's where people bought their meat. There were a few people in the community, mostly Hasidim, that wanted something more. Meaning, they wanted something that had Hasidish Shechita. That is not something that is halachic. In other words, even the rabbis who wanted this gave their approval to the other meat. It was fine, halachically. But Alts Minig, it's custom, many Hasidim are matbid, that there's certain Hidurim, certain extras that they want in order to be able to eat the meat, specifically who the shochtim are. And one of the examples that you should see is it makes no difference in the kashrus of the meat or not. It's just an extra nicety, right, that they're matped on, is that a shochet has to have a beard. Okay? That's not the only thing he had to have. He had also know how to be a shochet, right? But he had, in addition, have a beard. So shochetim who didn't have beards, who were perfectly from, perfectly knew what they were doing, but they didn't have a beard, that wasn't chassidus shechita. Chassidus shechita means shochet had to have a beard. There were other things also. But this is one of them. So they decided they're going to bring in meat for a small group of people who were makbir on chassidus shechita. Since it was only a small group, and they had to bring the meat in from out of town, it was extremely expensive. So they couldn't bring it in on a regular basis. They brought it in twice a year. And anybody who wanted this meat had to buy a freezer just for this meat and buy a 4/4 of an animal at a time. And the price, because it was brought in just for a small group of people, was about double the price of the regular meat. Okay. And they could only butcher it in a processing place that was in the middle of Florida, which was about 30 miles, what's it called, traveling both ways to be able to pick up this meat. Okay, so anybody who wanted it had to buy a freezer, had to pay double the cost of the meat, and had to travel 30 miles each way to pick it up, twice a year. Okay. So this woman tells me, my daughter came home, and she told me that the butcher shop that you buy your meat in and that you give the hashgacha to with all the other rabbis is not kosher. The only kosher meat is meat that I have to buy a freezer for, pay double, and travel 60 miles round trip to pick up twice a year. Now tell me, Rabbi, if you're an Orthodox rabbi, why does my daughter have to eat the kosher and you could eat the things from the regular butcher shop that's not kosher? I said, let me take care of this. I'll speak to your daughter. So I called her in, and I told her the following. I told her this, Das Sekenu Valiatosis. I said, you know what? Sometimes it would be very, very special for a person to be solid gold. But if you're not carrying yourself, and somebody else is carrying you, and you'd be too heavy to carry if you're solid gold, then maybe it's better not to be solid gold. Maybe it's just better to be gold on the inside and gold on the outside to be a little bit of wood. I said, you know, someday, Mirza Hashem, you'll get married, and you'll want to have this extra special kosher meat, and you'll be willing to pay the double and get the freezer and make the 60-mile trip, Matova Manoi. I give you all the credit in the world. But you're not the one who's spending the money. You're not the one who's buying the freezer. You're not the one who's making the 60-mile trip. It's your mother. If you want to be solid gold, but your mother has to carry you, and because you're solid gold, you're a little too heavy to carry, then maybe you shouldn't be solid gold. I said, that's the... If it would be treif, and the mother, you know, tells me, is it necessary? So fine, you want to be moser nefesh for your daughter to eat kosher, yeah. But if it's a hither, then the hither has to be, you carry it, not somebody else's. You're too heavy for somebody else to carry. So somebody wants to get up and say tikkun chatzos every night, you know, but he wakes up the whole family. So you're doing it at somebody else's expense. Maybe find another way of being frum instead of saying, or find another place to say tikkun chatzos. But don't make hidurim on somebody else's cheshbon. If somebody has to carry you, then maybe you can be less than solid gold than be the solid gold, right? If you're carrying yourself, you can be solid gold. If somebody else carrying you, shouldn't be solid gold. Okay. It's interesting that the various kalim in the Mishkan, right, were of different measurements. The aron, all the measurements were broken numbers, mixed numbers, fractions, no whole numbers. The aron, amah v'chetzi, amah v'chetzi, amah sayim v'chetzi, komaso, 1.5 by 1.5 by 2.5. The Shulchan was whole numbers in its length and width, and what's it called, in the height, it was a broken number. And the Mizbeach was all whole numbers, height, length, and width. What do you learn from that? When it comes to Torah, a person should never feel complete in any way. Everything is broken numbers, only fractions. Length, width, height, you should never feel complete when it comes to Torah. There's always place to improve. When it comes to the Shulchan was the Parnasa, Gashmias, physical things. That's what the Shulchan, the table with the bread on it, represented. There, a person should feel, be mistapik with what he has, right? Sumer Bechelko, be happy with what you have when it comes to physical things. So the length and the width was whole numbers. Feel complete. Except in the height, what you use your money for, how you elevate it, there you should feel incomplete. There you should always feel you can use your money for higher purposes, for better purposes. The height is not complete. The height is broken. When it comes to the Mizbeach, to the altar, and a person wants to sacrifice, there all the measurements have to be whole. We want to sacrifice, it should be complete. The sacrifice should be 100%. Height, length, width, everything, whole numbers. So that, I think, is a little bit of a hint why these different vessels were composed of different kinds of measurements. Okay, another idea. Okay, I'm just going to, before I get to the next idea, which might take us a little time, I must leave today on time, because I have to get home to give a shiur in Australia. And they're 9 hours difference, so I have to give the shiur at 11:30 our time, which is 8:30 in the morning, tomorrow morning their time. Okay, and I need to rest a little bit before I give that shiur. I'm giving it on, obviously, not in Australia, but by computer on Skype. So I must get back on time, and also not fall asleep. I don't mind if people fall asleep during my shiurim, but if I fall asleep during the shiurim, that may be a very big problem. So, okay, in any case, so you'll permit me to run out of here after the shiur. Okay. Let's speak about another topic, not to do with the Mishkan, the leap year. We're Mavarech Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph, and an extra month is being added, right? As another Adar. Question, which is the extra month, the second one, the first one, but in any case, one of them is the extra month. There's 13 months this year. Why? So the simple practical reason is because the Christians have a solar calendar. Everything goes according to the sun. And the year is 365 days and one quarter of a day. Every 4 years, you have to make up that quarter. So there's a leap year of an extra day in February. That's why every 4 years is an extra day. And since it's not exactly a quarter, every 100 years or whatever, they compensate for that. And it's a little bit less than a quarter. So every 100 years, they make the fourth year is a regular year. Okay, it works out. The Muslims have a lunar year, total lunar year. The lunar year is 12 months of 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 chalakim, which is about 44 minutes. That's the length of a lunar month, from when the time the moon, starts until it starts again in its lunar cycle. And there's only 354 days in a lunar year. Therefore, there's no connection between the solar year, which the seasons go by the sun, and the lunar year. Right? There's no connection between them. Therefore, every year by the Muslims, the seasons go backwards 11 days. In other words, if they have their Ramadan in January, this year, okay? Next year is going to be 11 days earlier in the end of December, because their Ramadan is going to come back 354 days later after 12 lunar months, but the solar year isn't going to be complete till 365 days, 11 days later. The next year is going to move 11 days earlier, right? So it's going to be in the beginning of December. until if you keep going year after year, sometimes it's going to be in the summer, sometimes in the spring, sometimes in the winter. That's why their Ramadan is not always in the same season. It goes, travels across the calendar season to season every year, changes 11 days earlier. If we did the same thing, if we only had a lunar calendar, then Pesach would come out in the winter sometimes, and in the summer sometimes, and in the spring sometimes. But the Torah said that can't be. Shomer is chodesh ta'aviv, basisa Pesach l'Hashem Elokim. Pesach must fall in the spring. Must fall in the spring. Okay, that means it must fall in the, it must have a connection to the seasons which are governed by the sun. The four seasons, 90 days and a quarter each, right, during the year, and 91 days and a quarter each, and there's the winter solstice, and the summer solstice, and the autumnal equinox, and the vernal equinox, the spring, and in order for Pesach always to be in the spring, there has to be some compensation for these 11 days. So therefore, six times in 19 years, I think it's six times, yeah, seven times? Seven times in 19 years, we add another month. And that way, what's it called, the 11 days in 3 years is a little bit more than a month. So it's not every 3 years, but it's seven times in 19 years. Okay, a little bit. And therefore, the, what's it called, we add another month. And that way, when it's, last year, everything was very, very early. Right, all the holidays, the Pesach was the earliest that Kemat ever comes. It was just at the beginning of spring, right? Chanukah was what's it called? It was in November, right? Thanksgiving and Chanukah in America came together, right? November. So all of the holidays were the earliest Kemat ever came. Therefore, it was necessary to add another month this year. So now Pesach will be, if we wouldn't have added the month, then Pesach would have been not in April, but in the beginning of March, right, when the second Adar is going to be. So it would have been very, very early. It would have been before the spring. So therefore, we had another month, and now Pesach will be in the spring. And so we compensate the solar and lunar together, right? We have basically a lunar year, but every few years, we add another month that the lunar year and solar year should remain in sync. What's the idea behind it? The idea is that the moon represents basically the next world, Olam Haba. So we have a lunar calendar because basically we, our main focus is on the next world. That's why the moon gets bigger and smaller. The moon in this world is small, but it represents renewal. The sun is always constant, doesn't renew, but the moon renews. Olam Haba is a new world. Right, world to come. So the fact that we have a lunar year represents a spiritual year. But the spirituality and this, the Goyim, the Christians, have a totally physical year. The sun represents physicality. They have physical. Tachas HaShemesh. Everything's under the sun. But we don't only have spiritual things because we bring Olam Haba into Olam Hazeh too. We make this world also a spiritual place. So there always has to be a synchronization between the physical and the spiritual. The Muslims, right, they're very spiritual, but it doesn't filter down into the physical. Physically, they're a bunch of behemoths, wild animals, right, para adam, right? Just look at the world, look what goes on in the world here, right, with Muslims everywhere, right? Not all Muslims are terrorists. But a good portion of the terrorists in the world are Muslims. So they don't really synchronize between their spiritual feelings and how it filters down into the physical world. We try to balance the two out, to bring spirituality into the physical world and physicality into the spiritual world. The Christians are basically physical, this world, oriented, right? Democracy, capitalism, materialism, that's the Christian world, Romans, the Western society. And Judaism is somewhere between. We want to emphasize the spiritual. Our main calendar is the moon. On the other hand, we might want the spiritual to be in synchronization with the physical too. They have to go together. We are called Anshe Kodesh, I think the Kotzker Rebbe says. Anshe Kodesh means Getlecha Menschen. You have to be a mensch, but you have to be a holy person. But you have to be a person, right? If you're just a holy somebody, an angel, that's no good. You have to be a mensch too. But you have to be a mensch who's holy, right? Not to be a mensch or not to be holy, neither one is good. You have to be both together. Okay, so that's the idea of a leap year. And that's why it's called a Shana Meuberes. We don't call it a leap year. We call it a pregnant year. Because that's the idea. An Uber is not really in this world yet, right? It's a different world. But the mice is part of the mother who is in this world. So there's a synchronization between the Uber and the mother. Okay. Another point. It says that the Mishkan was a place where modesty was important. The Mishkan was draped like a kala, like a bride. It had a veil in the front and a train in the back. The coverings of the Mishkan went in the front like a veil on a bride, and in the back like a train, like a kala's dress. So the Medrash says that when the Rabbanu Shalom, when they finished the Mishkan, the Rabbanu Shalom says, "Kan yofa hatznius." Here, modesty is in place. Now, what in the world's modesty have to do with the Mishkan? The Mishkan was not a body that you had to cover. It was a beautiful building. Why did it have to be covered? What's the concept of modesty? And we'll see this two other places where modesty is extra special. First, you have to understand what modesty is. Then we'll see where the other places are and why it applies to those three things specifically. Modesty is not covering your body because there's something wrong with the body. Because there's nothing wrong with the body. God created the body, and there's nothing wrong with it. It has to be covered. And in fact, in the beginning of the world, Adam and Chava didn't wear clothing. They didn't have to cover their bodies. Animals, we are not machmir, at least I don't know anybody who's machmir, not to go to the zoo unless the animals are dressed, right? So we're not machmir that animals should be dressed. The only place in the world I know where they dress their animals is in Los Angeles. There, the dogs and cats are dressed in mink coats and in mamamish, walking the streets there. That has nothing to do with modesty because the people aren't dressed. Just the animals. So if something wrong with the human body, there should be something seriously wrong with animal bodies. Why don't we cover them? Modesty is the following. Before the chait of Adam and Chava, it was clear that human beings are souls. We are souls. We were created as souls. We existed for thousands of years in a spiritual world as souls. That's what we are. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting around inside of us called the soul. We are souls. So what's our body? As long as we were in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without a body. We could see without eyes and hear without ears and get along very nicely without arms and legs. A soul can exist in a spiritual world. When the soul came into this physical world, it's like an astronaut. As long as an astronaut is on this planet, on terra firma, he doesn't need a special space suit to exist. He can breathe, he can walk, he can talk, fine. Goes to outer space. There he needs a pressurized suit because there's no air pressure. He needs a radio to talk because there's no sound waves. And he needs an oxygen apparatus to breathe because there's no oxygen. Comes back to Earth, he takes off the suit. As long as we were in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely as souls. But when the soul came into this physical world, it needed a space suit to wear to be able to function. It needed eyes to see and ears to hear and legs and arms to get around with. When we go back to the spiritual world after 120 years, we shed the suit, take the suit off, leave it here. You don't need it anymore. Could be that's one of the reasons that we express mourning for somebody who's passed away by tearing our clothing. To show it's only the clothing that's been torn away. But the essence of the person still exists. It's just the suit of clothing they wear in this world is no longer, they're not no longer connected to that suit of clothing. But the person still exists. They're living in a spiritual world and can function very nicely without that body. As long as Adam and Chava didn't sin, it was clear that the main thing of the person was the soul, and the body was just a suit of clothing that the soul wore to be able to function. It served the soul. But once they sinned and used their bodies against their soul, not in the better interest, now it's confusing. If the body is just to serve the soul, the body's doing things that aren't good for the soul. So maybe there is no soul. Maybe the body's the main thing. Now it's not clear anymore. So since the body is what we see, we cover the body to make the statement there's more here than meets the eye. Don't be distracted by the body because I'm not a body. There's more to me than meets the eye. And therefore, by an animal, where there is no more than meets the eye, there is no soul, you don't cover the body. There's nothing wrong with the body. But if you're going to be distracted by the body and forget that the main thing of a human being is not their body, it's their soul, then you have to cover the body in a tasteful way. We don't cover it completely. We cover it in a way that you can see the beauty of the soul reflected in the way a person dresses externally. You don't want the body to be distracting, right? Attracting. It can be attractive, but not attracting. In order that you shouldn't forget that the main thing of this person is not a body. You're not an animal. There's a soul that you can't see, and therefore don't be distracted by what you can see, because there's more here than meets the eye. That is what tznius is. Tznius is wherever there is an inner holiness, and you can be distracted by the externals and think that that's all there is. You have to cover the externals in order to say there's more here than meets the eye. Therefore, one place where tznius is extra special is the Mishkan. Based on the following story. I heard a story of Reb Shlomo Shvadron Zatzal, I think it was his grandchildren or children were by the coastal one Shabbos, and they saw an Israeli, right, who had one of these paper yarmulkes on, you know, the cardboard yarmulkes at the coastal, writing a kvittel and putting it on the coastal on Shabbos. So they ran over to him. They thought maybe somebody's deathly sick and he thinks I'll speak Ruach Nefesh, you're allowed to write a kvittel, which there is maybe an opinion that says like that. So they said, what are you doing at Shabbos? He said, somebody's sick, why are you writing this thing on Shabbos? He said, no, nobody's sick. I'm the captain of an Israeli soccer team and we have a championship match this week and I'm putting in a request from the wall that we win. If that's what the Kosel is, or for that matter, the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, it's a wishing wall, then it's no difference than mirror, mirror on the wall or wall on the ground, right? It's Avodah Zarah, almost like idolatry. What's the purpose of that wall? Because the Rabban Shlom's Shechina, his presence is there. But if you get distracted by the wall, the externals of the Mishkan, then you forget that the Ikar is what's inside. So we cover the Mishkan in order to make the statement, don't get distracted by the externals, the gold and the whatever of the externals, right? Know that there's something beneath the surface that's the main thing. Another place where we find that tznius is extra special is by Talmidei Chachamim. A Talmid Chacham has to be extra modest. That's why he dresses with a longer coat or whatever. It has to be extra modest. Why? Talmid Chacham is more erotic than a regular person. That's just wear more modest clothing, though. But there's a mitzvah to stand in awe of a Talmid Chacham. Es Hashem Elokecha Tira L'Rabos Talmidei Chachamim. That's a very dangerous thing. Because if you stand in awe and extra respect of the Talmid Chacham as an individual, as a personality, it borders on idolatry. You're making him into an idol. And there is personality cults around Talmidei Chacham sometimes. It's very dangerous. So the Talmid Chacham has to de-emphasize his external being and say, what you have to stand in awe of and respect is not me. It's a Torah that I possess. It's what you can't see. So what you can see, I distract attention from. You should know you're respecting not me, but the Torah that I represent. And the third place where tznius is extra special is women. So women who complain that Torah is too strict with them when it comes to modesty, they're in good company. They're in company of Talmidei Chachamim and the Mishkan. It's two other things. Why? Because in the secular world, women, for the most part, are judged by their external attributes. And even in this liberated and what's it called, progressive society, right, they still have Miss America pageants and Miss Universe pageants. And even though they say that now it's more, you know, refined, and they have the women reading their poetry and speaking about their careers, but since it's all done in bathing suits, I have the feeling that it's not the careers and the poetry that's the issue. So women are basically judged on their external attributes. And therefore, from the Torah standpoint, the woman is the foundation of Jewish holiness. Kedushas Yisrael, the woman is the foundation. It's not just a nice thing to say, it's true. Because what determines whether any human being has a Jewish holy neshama or not? Your mother. Unless you're a convert. Your father could have been Genghis Khan. But if your mother is a nice, sweet Jewish lady, you're Jewish. And your father could have been Moshe Rabbeinu. If your mother's not Jewish, you're not Jewish. So the woman is the one who determines whether anybody has Kedushas Yisrael. Right? Up until today, most mothers were women. So the Maisa, what's it called? Women are the foundation of Kedusha, of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, Jewish women have to be extra modest and make the statement, there's more here. Do not judge me on my externals. I'm not just a body. But there's more here than meets the eye, which is the main thing, which is the Kedusha that a woman represents. So those three cases, the Mishkan, Talmidei Chachamim, and women, their tznius is extra special because the Kedusha is extra, and there's always the danger of being misled by the externals and forgetting about the internals, so we de-emphasize the externals by covering them in order to make the statement there's more here than meets the eye.
The next shiur is February 25th, 4 weeks from tonight, okay? 4 weeks from tonight, please make your...